Okay, thank you to the organizers for inviting me to participate in this event. I feel a little bit out of my element as an engineer talking to physicists about biology, but hopefully you find something useful. And it's certainly an honor to follow Irina on the work on the StarFlag project. I think more so than any other work that I've seen in collective behavior really influenced the communities that I'm part of. Really was inspirational. Many of the tools, even technically speaking, about the stereo filming and so on, we used in our work as well. So it's a real pleasure to follow up. So I'm going to talk about fish and mosquitoes. I should have, if I'd known I was following you, I would have started with the mosquitoes. But if you bear with me, I'm going to talk a little bit about fish first, the first half of the talk. Then we'll come back. Many of the issues that were raised about time delays and the markers and the wind and all these great issues, hopefully we can continue that discussion in light of some of the data that we've collected with the mosquitoes. So basically, the approach that we take is similar, again, to the work that was just presented in regards to the fact that we need to track these organisms and generate all this flight data. As an aerospace engineer, I'm very concerned with things that move in a fluid, whether it's water or air, and so we're keen to understand, in particular, how networks of biological organisms do this so we can replicate them in robotics and other settings. And so we have a significant effort devoted to extracting the trajectories from primarily video footage and then using mathematical models to try to understand the principles. And then I won't have too much time to talk about it, but we do try to conduct experiments as well on the organisms to sort of manipulate them and try to tease that apart the different attributes and test the hypotheses that we generate. So as I said, I'll talk about fish and mosquitoes. I want to acknowledge the work on fish is really focused on information transmission in schools that are fish that are frightened by a visual stimulus. And this is work done with Cheryl Coombs, a biologist at Bowling Green, and my students Sachin and Amanda. The mosquito work was done with NIH. Nick Manukas is actually now at the USDA. I was telling Irina earlier that our group is kind of splintered a little bit. Nick is now working on fruit flies, not mosquitoes. And a lot of the work was done in Mali, which has political instability, so it's made it difficult to collect additional field data. But nonetheless, we have a nice data set from 2010 that we're working with to study swarming and mating, in fact. We're one of the first groups to actually be able to film females flying into these all-male swarms. Starting with fish, the fright response in fish is very quick and involves a rapid contortion of their body and sometimes referred to as a C start or an S start, depending on the shape. These different rows here are different species, but when fish are frightened, they rapidly accelerate in an escape response, and that's something that we film at high frame rates in order to understand, to understand the propagation of information in the school. And this propagation, I'm surprised that slide is gone, but I guess I was worried about time, so I took it out. But I'll tell you what you would have seen, which was that information in fish schools propagates like a wave as startled fish startle their neighbors and so on. So not all the fish perceive the external threat necessarily, but they perceive each other's response to that threat, and that information transmits to the school like a network. Classical models of how this works fail to match experimental data. If you just look at the sort of, if you look at a model in which there's no social interaction, just each fish has a certain probability of detecting external stimulus, and you look at the expected number of fish versus the size of the school, you get a linear dependence that does not at all fit the observed response in fish that has a superlinear growth there, which indicates that there's this transmission of information amongst the fish themselves. So that's what we set out to study. So some of the notation, the probability of response by fish eye, the number responding to external threat. So this is the model that we actually want to replace. Here's the slide. I already explained it to you, but here's this wave. Time progresses from left to right here, and this is a propeller that startles the fish, and the startled fish startle their neighbors and so on, and you get this transmission information. This was studied many decades ago. So one of the tools that we sought to apply to this, thinking about networks as sensor networks, in fact, is to apply signal detection theory. And to really understand the response of the fish in the context of this basic framework, where if you're familiar with this framework, it characterizes the signal probability when you have signal plus noise versus the noise-only stimulus. And the sort of separation of these two probability densities is described as the sensitivity, or D prime. And then the threshold above which you make a decision to call a detection is your bias criterion. And so, you know, this gives you, depending on where you draw this vertical blue line, you can have missed positives or you can have false positives, and there's a whole family of different outcomes. But the sort of maximum likelihood one is the one that divides it in the middle. And so the question is, well, do individual fish, of course, have these sort of characteristics, but do schools of fish have these characteristics as well, and what influences them? And so the hypothesis that we wanted to explore was the degree to which the polarization or alignment of the school, as well as the density, sort of influences their sensitivity to external threats. And we ended up drawing conclusions that were very different from what we started out believing. But to do this, we had to develop tracking systems. And I actually pulled out my slide, so I applaud you, Irina, for including your slide on the tracking. But this is just one movie I wanted to show you. This is several years of effort to track the fish in 3D, and in particular to track the curvature of the spine, which of course is what we need if we want to detect startle responses. These primarily were done at very high frame rates, and we had, you know, difficulty applying as much light as was needed without overheating the fish tank. So what were the findings? So we stuck the fish in a flowing water tank, and of course they exhibit their natural tendency to orient upstream, known as rheotaxis. So this is our no flow. These are the orientations of the fish, and when you turn on the flow, they prefer to orient upstream in the zero direction. They also they also distribute themselves differently in the flow tank. And you can see a little picture here of the fish in no flow and in the flow. So it's not only that they're aligned, but their neighbor position density changes in flow too. And they have this sort of this tendency to sort of spread out in the cross stream direction. And so we have some thoughts about why that might be. So then we startled them. This is a visual looming stimulus that represents a predator rapidly approaching the fish. And this is our view. The fish view comes from either one of two monitors on either side of the tank. The position, the monitor itself is randomized, and the position on the screen is randomized. There we go. We wanted to understand the impact of their polarization on their overall response to this threat. Did polarized schools perform better, quote unquote, or worse? And so that's why we had them in the flow, is to take advantage of their rheotaxis tendencies. So we saw some interesting sort of anecdotal evidence of social transmission of information. Notice in this video that the stimulus does invoke startle responses. By the way, these are slowed down dramatically, these videos, because they're recorded at high frame rates. The duration of a startle response is just about 100 milliseconds. So these are much slower than real time. Having said that, the point of this slide is that the stimulus ends, and then we see additional fish startling, right? So. And that's beyond the sort of latency that you would expect from like a neural response in the fish. So anecdotally, you know, there's evidence here that, well, some of the fish were startled from the external threat, and other fish were startled because of their neighbor interactions. And that's just based on the timeline of this. So here's sort of the data that we were able to extract from this. And so we looked at we compared the flow and the no flow case, and we looked at the sort of cumulative number of fish responding here. And generally speaking, the black and the white bars here were roughly similar, so that it was a little hard to tease apart their differences. But in fact, if you look at the sort of threshold around 3, you see that it's more likely in flow to have these sort of fewer than 3 fish, 3 or fewer fish responding. Whereas in NoFlow, we sort of have these instances that are more likely that greater than three fish are responding. And so, and indeed, we were able to sort of fit these cumulative distributions to these polynomial fits. And so what that allowed us to do was actually fit the parameters of a model. So the model we used, I later discovered, was already existed, as is often the case. In fact, it was it appeared in literature on computer viruses, in fact, in epidemiology. So it's exactly the same model as X, except we have false alarms in our model. But otherwise, it's the same. And basically, it's a probabilistic model that says that the probability of a fish startling it depends on the probability of it startling in the absence of a stimulus, the false alarm rate, probability of it being startled in the previous time step and remaining startled, that's our P sustained, and then the probability of startling based on the fact that a neighboring fish that the focal fish is interacting with is startled in the previous time step. Okay, and so that's the model. It's actually kind of fun to play with the parameters of this model. But at the end of the day, we're looking for the probability of response of the fish eye, and now at time t. So that's one way it differs from the classical models. We have this sort of temporal evolution. But otherwise, this is the same quantity that the classical model predicts. And then the role of the external, the probability of detection of the external threat is sort of how we sort of initialize the model. So at time 0, every fish has an opportunity to detect the external threat, which only lasts for that one time step, and then we sort of integrate the model and we look at how the startle propagation occurs, depending on the sort of this network, how we choose the quote unquote neighbors of the fish, whether they're metric or topological interactions. So we actually simulate this model many times in a Monte Carlo sense and we fit the output of the model to the data that we collected, and we got these plots. And the plots are the parameters p external, so the probability of detecting the external threat, and p internal, which is the probability if you're interacting with a neighbor and that neighbor startles, the probability that I will also startle. How contagious is the startle? And of course, we don't know who the neighbors are, so that was one problem. But we sort of hypothesized, well, what if it was a nearest neighbor type of topology, or what if it was some sort of metric topology? And we looked at both possibilities over a range of interaction distances. And found out that actually didn't really matter what the topology was. We got the same sort of trends. And the trends were that in the flow, which is the black squares, there was a heightened probability of detecting the external threat, okay? But a diminished probability of interaction. And so this was actually, I confess, the opposite of what we thought would happen. We really were surprised that the polarized fish that had very little relative motion between each other were actually, the evidence was that their likelihood of interacting in this way was lower than for the fish who were in a non-polarized configuration. Okay, and so this is where we started to think a little bit about the sensory modality that was involved in this information transmission. And so we came up with yet another hypothesis to sort of explain this, which we haven't fully tested, but it involves the fact that the hydrodynamic signals that the fish generate. So our flow signals produced by the movements of neighboring fish masked by the flow, inhibiting the transmission of hydrodynamic information. So in fact, we're studying this problem, but that would be an entirely different talk. But just to say a few words about it, the lateral line system in fish, in fact, I'm giving a talk tomorrow afternoon, if anybody is interested, in the next building after the conference ends, about this problem. But the lateral line system in the fish is used in reataxis, and it's also used in interactions between fish. And the realization we came to is that when we put the fish in flow in order to polarize them, we actually potentially saturate their lateral line system. So we diminish their ability to interact with one another through hydrodynamic signals. And that might explain the reduction in the internal probability, the probability of responding to internal interactions. So that's kind of a very quick overview of that work. And now I'm going to turn to the mosquito work. Are there any questions about the fish work before we move on? Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. There was a really complicated experimental protocol to avoid habituation. I hired a student who knew how to do that. I don't know how to do that, but I think we addressed it. Pretty small, 8 fish. Yeah. We looked at individual fish and 8 fish, and that was really just a limitation of space and tracking and presumably they are. You know, it's interesting, when we saw the different formations of the fish, the fact that the fish and flow sort of spread out but remained in the field of view of the other fish was something that was also observed in work in the 80s, where a fish whose lateral line system was artificially ablated, they also went into that type of formation where they tended to be side by side. And presumably that's to enhance their visual, you know, sensing of each other. I don't know if that's where you're going with that. It's really hard to say because we just don't know enough about the perceptual geometry of these different sensory systems. It was three-dimensional. Not a whole lot, because again, we really only were filming during the period of the startle, which was very, very short. It's just we filmed at a high frame rate. So they moved very little in the duration of our experiments.
Okay, I think let's do that afterwards.
It's my fault. I asked you if you wanted to ask me. All right, mosquitoes. Irene's really lucky because her midges swarm in Rome, I guess. We had to go to Africa, there's actually a swarm there. They only form at twilight, you really don't want to get bitten. But luckily, the males don't bite. Only the females take blood meals. But the male swarms form at twilight. Females are attracted to them, presumably through acoustic or chemical means, or olfactory means, and then they enter the swarm and they mate. So there, medical entomologists are really interested in this phenomenon because arguably Anopheles gambiae is the world's deadliest animal. I find myself continuing to compare with the work. You really described exactly the hassle that we went through when you talked about your early attempts where you picked up all your equipment and ran to find the swarm. That's what we ended up doing. So we never came up with that nice backdrop and the marker system. That would have made it a lot easier. Instead, we fortunately had a lot of villagers helping and a UPS system. This is our portable filming system. This is my student Sachit, and there's the stereo camera. And that's how we did it. You were, and I intentionally put it up because it's almost impossible to see them because they only swarm at twilight. It's under natural lighting, so we tend to film in the direction of the setting sun. We almost always had the cameras oriented to the west, so they appear as these black spots. There's a sort of human-aided tracking system here that uses stereo vision, and it reconstructs these mating events. There's sort of a trick here to identify the female, the red, we actually track backwards from the couple. The couple's quite big and slow, and so we can track backwards and figure out which one is the female. So we tracked all these swarms and the mating events in Mali. So here's some of the data. The gray is something like the 1 sigma or something, or maybe 3 sigma, I can't remember. So that perimeter of the swarm. And again, we tended to orient the inertial frame east-west and north-south. We also recorded the wind and the wind direction, so sometimes we look at the upwind and crosswind direction as well. And so here's what the data looks like. Here's a model, back to velocity autocorrelation, and this nice oscillatory response. And so this is something that Akubo studied and posited way back when. It turns out that fit really well, and so we just use that model. The idea is basically the individuals are attracted to the centroid via these damp springs, and the challenge is just to fit the data to uncover these parameters, the natural frequency and the damping ratio. And indeed, we can make simulated swarms that have the same characteristic. So here's what it looks like over a number of different swarms, the natural frequency and the damping ratio. And we, again, in this case, broke down the motion into the downwind direction, the crosswind direction, and then vertical. There's a couple things to point out about this chart. One is that S is the S type. Anopheles gambii actually has two incipient subspecies, S and M, the molecular types. S, generally speaking, forms of anywhere. M, the M type, generally forms swarms over markers. And nearly all of the species that we, or the subspecies that we found were S type. And that's known because we actually caught a couple of the mosquitoes from each swarm that we filmed and then tested them in the lab to see which type they were. So the general trends were that the vertical motion, this was sort of the big insight here, the vertical motion was much lower frequency and much higher damping. And generally speaking, unit damping ratio is sort of critically damped. So these were overdamped, often, motions in the vertical. And the horizontal motion, really in both the sort of in the wind direction and the crosswind direction, tended to be higher frequency and underdamped. And that's generally consistent with our visual observations of the data. The wind did have a strong role. We didn't have too many windy days, but when we on the days that we did, the synchronization in the swarm was amazing. They just formed this rolling motion, and so it was definitely a strong component of the wind, and it showed these really high frequency patterns here. Okay, but aren't they interacting? They're swarms, so the centroid model carries you so far, but it doesn't carry you all the way. And so we looked at neighbor distance. I think these are first, second, and third. So the circle is the closest neighbor, triangle second closest, square is the third closest. So generally speaking, we would see these lines going from circle to triangle to square, sort of increasing. And this is the disagreement in the direction of motion. Okay, so they're definitely not synchronized, right? Because then the disagreement would be zero. But they're also not random. They're sort of less than random level of disagreement. And on the windy day, as I said, there's a great deal of synchronization, which in a mosquito swarm means that you only disagree about 65 degrees on average in your direction of motion. So we want to kind of get at this rather than sort of a macroscopic view, a microscopic view, and really look at the interactions between the mosquitoes since we have the data for individual mosquitoes. And so that's kind of that's the approach that we took. We started to look at these cross correlations. So we got pretty far with the autocorrelation, and we started to look at cross correlation. We normalized the 3D velocities so that we're just looking at the unit velocities. And we found some interesting trends. So if you start with just a random walk, then you really have no trends here in the histogram of the unit velocity cross correlation. That's the gray line. If you look at the real swarms, the blue, then you get this type of effect. And this dip here is sort of artificial, the fact that we're averaging over about a dozen or so swarms. It's not really bimodal. And if you look at our simulated, the Akubo-based model with just the centroid force and no interactions between the insects, then you get this green curve, okay? But the problem with the green curve is it kind of dies out. There's fewer high correlation, cross-correlation interactions, really, than we see in the data. And just for comparison, the male-female couples show these really heightened cross-correlation as they sort of synchronize their flight trajectories right before they form a couple. And so we want to kind of get at that. And so what we did is we set a threshold here where at the intersection of the green and red curves. And we set a pretty high threshold. So we sort of had a low false alarm rate, about 5%. But we said that we can identify the insects as interacting. These are male-male interactions now, if they show an instantaneous univelocity cross-correlation greater than the threshold. That's sort of a metric for determining whether or not there was an interaction. And so we were able to actually create or induce from the data these interval graphs, where these are individual. This is a swarm with many more insects than this, but we're just looking at six insects here, labeled A through F. Okay, and then the interactions between, this is time, the interactions between the insects indicate a high degree of velocity cross-correlation. So they're basically flying in the same direction for a short period of time, but for a longer period of time than just an accidental coincidence. Sorry about the typo here. The males form synchronized subgroups whose size and members change dynamically in time. This is an animation showing the interactions, not in space here, but just in time. The position of the nodes here, the mosquitoes, is random. But you see that there are these sort of clusters, and this is the main observation, that there are clusters of two or more insects flying in the same direction very, very frequently in these swarms. Okay, and that's the main finding. The directionality of the linkages, in fact, is something that we deduce by the latency in the cross-correlation. We look at over a range of latencies in a leader-follower sense to find the sort of the one that has the strongest cross-correlation. And so we can actually determine whether or not there's a directed interaction or not. So we augmented the model in a very simple way, the simplest way we could think of, which was to just put a damper, not even a damp spring, but just a damper between interacting males. Okay. So there's no preferential separation distance between the males. There's just periodically a tendency to match velocities. And that was the tweak in the model. And preliminary analysis, this is sort of very recent, generated result, but that the old green curve is now dashed, and the new green curve, when we include that interaction term in the model, has this sort of nice heightened probability of these high cross-correlation interactions, a little bit better fit to the data. Although we do have quite a few parameters in the model, as simple as it is, that we still are working to justify. Okay, just in the last couple minutes here, with regard to male-female interactions. So the male swarms have this nice centroidal forcing, but also these pairwise interactions where they match velocities very frequently. What about the females? The females sort of fly into the swarm. Here's six instances. The female, I think, is red. The male's blue. Here's a better one. Yeah, so the female's red, the male's blue, and the couple's purple. The couple kind of falls to the ground. But the female passes through the swarm several times, in fact. And it's sort of like, well, what's going on? I mean, is in certain species, it has been shown, not in Anopheles gambi, but that female selection may be taking place, although the conventional wisdom that she flies into the swarm is just sort of grabbed by a male. We really have the data to try to understand that. So here are six mating events. We really haven't gotten very far with this analysis, but some of our thoughts are to sort of analyze the separation distance because, in fact, in many of these mating events, you see that the separation distance goes to almost zero several times before the couple forms, which is sort of what we sort of depicted by this data. So everything is sort of time synced to the moment the couple forms. And so you see, I don't want to go so far as to call it courtship, but you see interactions over several seconds prior to, even 5 seconds prior to that couple forming. And likewise, you see there's an interesting relationship between the speeds. The female generally flies faster, she's in red here, than the male, but the male speeds up. The male does speed up towards the end. So we call those close encounters. So we have some models. I intentionally haven't shown you the equations just because they don't work that well, and we're still trying to figure out what the right model is. One of the things that's hard, though, so what we did here, you know, so the blue is the real male, the green are all these different simulated males according to these sort of dynamic pursuit models that we're playing with, but none of them do a really good job of matching the blue trajectory. And part of the problem is, if it really is a mutual interaction, then the red curve, the female, is responding to the blue curve. And we can't really reproduce that unless we also model the female behavior. So this is a challenging problem, and we're still thinking about it. So that's it. I think I'm out of time. Thank you for your attention.
So thank you. Are there questions? Yes, here.
Yes, I have two questions. The first one is how large are these mosquito swarms that you have been looking at? And
it's not as big as yours.
No, okay. I just wanted to know whether you noticed a dependence of, for example, the correlation that you measure, the large correlation that you showed us, which has a consistent probability in the natural swarms, a dependence of that on the density of the swarm, the size, these features here.
Yeah, we have those plots. I can show you them afterward. But okay. Yeah, there are some dependencies that we're trying to sort out. I don't want to go on record as sort of.
Okay.
But we have looked at, we have the data, and maybe we can talk about it. First question, the swarms were anywhere from, I think the upper limit of the ones that we tracked were around 50, but anywhere from sort of like 6 to 50 was sort of the range of swarm sizes that we looked at. So we don't have any data for really large swarms. We just didn't track any that big. We intentionally didn't film any that big.
Okay, and then another question. I mean, is the speed of the pair of male-female much smaller than, I mean, you said that it's easy to recognize the pair because it's much slower than the other ones.
Yeah. Well, you can see here, the couple forms, if you can see that dashed line, okay. The data to the, this is speed, the data to the right of that dashed line, it shows the speed of the couple. And generally speaking, it's slower than either the male or the female. The other general observation is that the females fly much faster than the male until the last few moments where the male can often speed up to match that flight speed of the female. I mean, one hypothesis about this sort of velocity matching behavior in the male-male interactions is that that's their sort of natural reaction to seeing another insect. And they in a sense pursue the other males until they realize it's not a female. But we can't say for sure.
Okay, further questions? Okay, I don't see any further questions, so thank the speaker again. So, and the session is closed.